Record. Guys, what is the crack? Welcome to the podcast. Today I've got Mark Morton from Skilling Digital Mining with me, and Mark's going to chat and explain to us a little bit about consensus mechanisms, I suppose, proof of work and maybe proof of stake we'll get into. But Mark, you're very welcome, man.
Cheers, Denny. Thanks for having me back. It's been a while.
Yeah, as you were just saying, a lot's happened since we had you on the last time. How are you surviving this bear market down there in Cork?
We're getting there. I suppose we're making the most of it. You know, we kind of had this kind of long time preference anyway when we started Skilling. And so we were almost kind of dying for a bear market to come back around, because when we were getting set up, you know, we kind of started building the whole business around 2020, 2021. And so we were sitting there watching price rocketing and the price of ASICs rocketing alongside it. And we were thinking, God, you know, have we missed the boat? So, you know, it's kind of bittersweet. Obviously, you're watching the price of Bitcoin come down, and but at this stage, you know, we don't really focus on that. We're kind of just focusing on building our business here and all the different possibilities that it could possibly do. And so overall, you know, we're pretty happy. We're making the most of it while we can. So I suppose, in our opinion, long may it last. But it'd be nice, I suppose, to get Bitcoin ticking back up again at some stage.
Yeah. You're sort of like me. I get excited in the bear markets because it's my second one now, and all the magic of my portfolio happened by the decisions I made in the bear market, not the decisions I made in the bull market.
Yeah, exactly. It's hard to not find yourself, you know, chasing your tail a small bit and getting caught up in the kind of frothiness of the bull market. So, you know, we were kind of lucky that we kind of stepped away in the bull market and realized that, you know what, you know, if we've missed the boat here, then so be it. But we're just going to, you know, take our time and do things methodically and do our due diligence and everything that we're doing. And, you know, I suppose thankfully and to an extent, you know, the bear market did come back around, and, you know, we had placed ourselves nicely to just keep building the same as we were, but, you know, without the pressure and the rush that, you know, a lot of people felt that they were in.
Awesome. Let's get into it a little bit. The price of energy, it's increasing. We all feel it. I'm even, when I leave the room now, I'm more conscious of turning off a light switch. Well, why do you think that is? And I'll throw a heap of questions at you since I have you on, and I'll be delighted to pick your brains. But why do you think the price of energy is increasing, and do you think it's likely to continue increasing, level out, or come down? And is this of any concern to Bitcoin miners or network security?
Yeah, you know, obviously, since I think the last time we spoke was probably in February, which is, you know, just before everything, you know, really kind of kicked off in Ukraine and Russia. And obviously since then we've had, you know, gas being cut off to Germany and the rest of Europe, and we've had sanctions, and, you know, that obviously hasn't helped with the price of electricity across Europe. You know, that's kind of contributing a large part of the fact that, you know, electricity is rocketing in price. And obviously now we're coming into the winter months where, you know, you might not be getting as much generation from your renewables. And so, you know, we're kind of in a horrible situation, which is as we come into winter, we're not getting as much production as we might have wanted. And now the supply is also dipping as well. So, you know, it's kind of a horror story for us here in Europe, which is we're getting hit on both sides. And obviously, you know, you're seeing the price of electricity skyrocket. But I suppose from our standpoint, that when we started Skilling and when we were focusing on it as a miner, we in general realized that the price of electricity, even, you know, 18 months to 2 years ago, was going to be, you know, a bit too high to try and compete. You know, you've got some guys in Texas running off of 2.5 cent, you know, a kilowatt hour. And, you know, when we were kind of starting the business, even, you know, on the Irish grid, you'd be looking at, you know, 11 or 12. And obviously now it can be 3-4 times that. So we were kind of started our model with this focus on, you know, stranded energy. And, you know, we decided early on we never really wanted to compete with the grid, because that's just going to be, you know, a lose-lose. You're going to have people, you know, giving out that, you know, you're taking energy off the grid that could be used in a different solution. And also it doesn't work for us anyway, you know, economically, which is, you know, a couple of months ago when we were getting our mining operation set up, you know, I was listening on the radio to people saying, across the EU, that, you know, mining was, you know, worsening the situation because, you know, we were consuming energy, but in reality, you know, there wasn't a soul that would be mining on European grids because the price of electricity was so expensive. So obviously you're dealing with that kind of narrative issue. But, you know, overall, as I said, the past kind of 7 or 8 months just hasn't been kind to Europe on the energy standpoint. You know, it's really kind of questioned our energy security across the continent. And, you know, the kind of worrying thing is that this winter, it seems like it's probably going to get worse before it gets better. But, you know, as I said, from our perspective anyway, you know, we've always just focused on stranded energy, you know, away from the grid. So it hasn't affected us much. But I imagine that there's definitely, you know, some miners across the globe that are probably feeling the pinch at the moment, that might have committed to, variable power purchase agreements or whatever it might be. And they might have thought that was fine when the price of Bitcoin was at 65,000. But, now that the price of Bitcoin is coming down and their electricity could be going up, or, that's when you're seeing, miner margins really getting squeezed, and you might start to see some miners kind of in distress in the coming months. But, they might have hedged their bets correctly. Only time will tell, really.
Sure. Lovely stuff. One thing that I wanted to talk to you about was this phrase within the Bitcoin space, and it's a failure to understand proof of work is a failure to understand Bitcoin. Can you really break down proof of work into layman's terms just to help us understand, why you think this is a superior consensus mechanism?
Mm-hmm.
Or even just how it works, I suppose, as well.
Yeah, well, in the simplest terms, proof of work is basically a civil resistance mechanism, which essentially is, how do you incentivize people to put skin in the game and operate in an honest manner to maintain the integrity and the honesty of the chain of truth, which is essentially the blockchain itself? And the way Bitcoin does that is with proof of work, which is, if you want to participate in mining, you have to buy a machine, you have to pay for energy, and that's essentially your skin in the game. And so if you're putting in that capital expenditure and that input from yourself, and you're taking on that cost, then that encourages you to be a good actor and abide by the rules of the blockchain itself. So that's kind of, my general, simplest explanation of it, which is, if you're a very large miner, you inevitably have greater skin in the game, which is, people worry if certain miners get more and more hash rate, do they pose a threat? Well, they're exposing themselves to more and more risk and more skin in the game. And so as a result of that, they're even more incentivized to behave as they should.
Very good. Is there any cause for concern with mining centralization? You hear a little bit about that chatted about, because it's difficult to mine now, and it's easier to mine in a pool.
Yeah, overall, I don't really think that proof of work exposes itself to a centralization issue like that. You do have a number of pools that operate and are obviously taking in hash rate from all over the world, and they're operating on behalf of other people, and obviously you have very large miners as well. But overall, I think, a great example of it recently is, the issues that Poulin had, where they halted withdrawals from their pool. And as soon as those withdrawals started being halted, you just saw hash rate completely die off from that pool. It collapsed from, I think it was the fourth biggest pool, I think it's probably sitting in eighth now. And switching your hash rate to and from pools is, a very, very simple system. I suppose the key thing that I find with Bitcoin's proof of work is the disparity between miners and nodes. So there's this kind of general, idea, and people seem to think that, miners themselves can dictate how this network works and the path that it takes. But ultimately, it's the nodes that make that final decision. Anything that has any, as well, simplest way to describe it is, any computer program that has a full copy of the Bitcoin ledger essentially can, vote and participate in the network. So, miners themselves can't dictate how the Bitcoin network works. You had a situation which was, a couple of months ago, there was, some miners talking about green Bitcoin blocks and green Bitcoin. And then you had, general kind of uproar in the Bitcoin community. And ultimately, I think if miners started going down that route and trying to throw their weight around and dictate where the network goes, you still have that disparity between nodes and miners and nodes and the consensus mechanism, which is, nodes won't allow it. And so I think that's, extremely important. And when you look back at, previous issues that are issues amongst the Bitcoin community, like the block size wars, where some large exchanges and, centralized custodians, et cetera, wanted to implement, bigger block sizes, the nodes at the end of the day were the ones that stood up and said no. And I think that's a really important thing for people to realize, which is, they seem to think that, these large, whether it be public listed miners that might have, ideas that don't quite align with the Bitcoin community, the Bitcoin community overall and the anonymous nodes around the world are the ones that will ultimately decide. So I personally don't see a big issue with the centralization of hash rate. And, aside from all of that, hash rate, I think overall, is just going to continue to become more decentralized, in my honest opinion. So you will have large facilities of a couple of hundred megawatts mining, but you're also seeing, stranded gas mining and, methane capture mining becoming increasingly popular, which is, you could have 100 kilowatts of mining on a landfill, you could have 200 kilowatts on an oil and gas field, you could have some co-located with an anaerobic digester, and slowly but surely then you're naturally distributing hash rate around the world, which I think is, methane capture mining is something that's kind of exploding in popularity recently, and people are doing a lot of research on it and the kind of positive effects it can have for Bitcoin and decentralization of the network. So overall, I think that we're heading in the right direction as opposed to a centralizing and negative direction.
Deadly. You chatted a little bit about how the nodes have power within in the network. Could you explain to us in as simple terms as you can how this sort of works?
Yeah, well, I suppose the simplest terms that I can explain to people, which
Or
is,
maybe Mark, sorry, we better go back a step further. What's a node? We better start there.
yeah, well, in the simplest terms, a node is just anything, any kind of computer program is the best way that I can describe it that has a full copy of the Bitcoin ledger. And essentially, it's your way of voting on the consensus within the Bitcoin network. So, we run a node here in the office. All of us as individuals in Skilling have nodes running at home. And that's essentially, our little vote or our little contribution to the consensus on the Bitcoin network, which allows us to, dictate ultimately where the network goes. And I think at the moment, there's 20 something thousand visible nodes that you can look up. I think there's a website called Bitnodes if people are interested in looking at it, which shows you visible nodes around the world and their distribution. So they're literally all different people that can vote and participate in where the Bitcoin network goes. And then you probably have, another huge amount that aren't visible. So these are all basically contributors and participants in the Bitcoin network, aside from the miners themselves.
Okay, cool. And how do they have influence over the network decisions or the monetary policy, I guess?
Yeah, well, I think what's important with nodes is that there isn't, a distinct monetary relation to decisions that they have to make. So ultimately, the kind of one thing that I worry about when I think about Ethereum is the fact that they've essentially combined those two together, and that in the, nodes and validators essentially are now combined on Ethereum. So you've removed the mining process, and those that have a greater stake monetarily essentially also have kind of a better influence or a greater influence over the direction the project takes. So if you were to take the block size wars as an example, or centralized entities wanting to implement something like that, if Bitcoin was possibly on a proof of stake standard back then, it's possible that it would have been implemented because the little guy wouldn't have been able to chime in and say, no, I don't want that to happen. So I think that's a really crucial part of Bitcoin's proof of work is that disparity between, yes, miners might hold a lot of Bitcoin, yes, they might have a lot of hash rate, but at the end of the day, they can't throw that weight around to the same extent in order to dictate where the project goes. So I think, removing that really direct link between, your monetary holding of the crypto asset itself and your ability to dictate where the asset or where the network goes is really, really important. I think Bitcoin does that extremely well.
Deadly. The last time you were on, we were talking a little bit about mining, and you were explaining that it's not they're not solving complex math problems. It's more like a lotto. And because this podcast, I'm trying to, really go through mining. Would you be able to just explain to us how Bitcoins are created? Like, because a lot of people, when they don't understand, they just think it's a digital thing, and like most digital things, it can be replicated, copied, or for all intents and purposes, created out of fresh air. But when we understand it, we realize that it's proof of work. It's in exchange for energy. It's backed by energy, is how I see Bitcoin. But maybe could you explain the process of how a Bitcoin is created, or the mining process?
Yeah, I suppose it's just best to draw back to the beginning, which is, the simplest thing is, getting an ASIC. So it might be an S19 or a Watts miner, and essentially then finding the energy that you need to plug it in. But as you said and you alluded to, all these machines essentially are doing is just firing guesses. So they're basically participating in a lottery that occurs every 10 minutes. So a blockchain essentially looks, Bitcoin blockchain looks like a conveyor belt. You have, box after box after box. And as soon as the last box comes off the conveyor belt, the next box comes along and puts up its hand and says, I have a combination code at the top in my header. And if I want to be added to the blockchain, a machine needs to guess this code correctly. Otherwise, I won't be added. And that's all these machines are doing every 10 minutes is firing these guesses. And as soon as a machine guesses correctly, that block is added to the blockchain. But what a pool does is it pools people's guesses together. So if you were to turn on, a machine, the likelihood of you winning or guessing this correctly, I think the average it could take you is about 27 years. So there's billions and billions of combinations that this guess could be. So what you do is you essentially send your guesses to a pool, which basically means it's like joining a lottery syndicate, whereby if you're participating in the pool and your machine doesn't win, but another machine in the pool wins, then you share the reward proportionately amongst all the machines in the pool. So if there's a 1,000 terahashes, which is 1,000 terahash machines, and I'm sending one, or my one machine that I own is sending guesses, then I get 10% of the 6.25 Bitcoin. And the 6.25 Bitcoin is the block reward. So the pool that wins the block or guesses correctly is given the 6.25 Bitcoin. And then that Bitcoin is distributed proportionally amongst everyone that was sending their guesses to that pool. And that's how the Bitcoin is distributed every 10 minutes. And essentially that process will go on until when you combine that process, the block reward process and the halving with the difficulty adjustment, which is people keep asking me is, okay, if you brought on 1 million machines over the course of the next 6 months, surely all the Bitcoin will be mined within the next 5 years. But you know, Bitcoin has the difficulty adjustment built in, which is the nodes look back over the previous 2016 blocks, which is usually around 2 weeks. And generally a block is meant to be guessed, is the better word to use, every 10 minutes. But if it's faster, the network automatically makes it more difficult. So then you're keeping that steady issuance of Bitcoin every 10 minutes, and you don't have blocks being solved every 5 seconds for the next 5 years and all the Bitcoin is gone, essentially.
Sure, yeah. So how the Bitcoins are created is I buy an ASIC, which is a specialist computer that I can plug in to mine Bitcoin. Then I'll run Bitcoin software, and if I'm lucky enough or my pool is lucky enough, depending on the power I'm putting into the pool, the software itself will decide to allocate the 6.25 Bitcoins to say my pool or my machine. This is how it works. And then my machine creates the block. What does that, because I've heard that, what can you explain that a little bit to me?
Well, essentially, it's not even that your machine is creating the block. The network is basically rewarding mining participants with it. So your machine is essentially just firing a guess, and it's being rewarded with it. You know, your machine isn't creating anything itself. You know, essentially, the network is just rewarding the participants with the 6.25 Bitcoin based on the algorithm itself. So when I take a new ASIC in here and I set it all up, I just direct its hash rate to a pool. And the pool knows how many guesses or how much hash rate I'm sending. And then it rewards me with my proportional amount of Bitcoin that I'm owed for that. So it's the network that's rewarding the participants as opposed to the machines themselves creating Bitcoin, which is probably where, you know, some confusion arises. And it's one of those questions, which is people assume that, you know, where you put the ASIC is where the Bitcoin is created to an extent, which, you know, isn't the case. You know, irrespective of where a pool is based, you know, it really makes no difference. And the network rewards Bitcoin at 6.25 Bitcoin every 10 minutes, irrespective of what pool wins, irrespective of where the pool is or where the guesses within that pool is coming from. So it's not a case, as I said, where the machines themselves are creating anything. They're just being rewarded proportionally based on the guesses that they're sending and the proof of work that they're doing, essentially.
Okay, so let's just talk a little bit about the ledger side of it then. My transaction, if I put through a Bitcoin transaction, it's not my ASICs miner that's trying to put that transaction onto the blockchain. That transaction exists just on the blockchain. And all the ASICs job is to do is to just unlock the part of the... Go on, you explain that to me. I'm stumbling a bit. You can see me struggling.
Well, it's the pools that, you know, build the blocks. So pools will dictate, you know, what transactions go into which block. So a block can actually be mined empty. So generally, it's meant to be 6.25 Bitcoin that's distributed to miners for participating in the mining process. But you also get the transaction fees on top of that occurred in that 10-minute period. So if you go back and look at the block rewards for the past 10 blocks, a lot of the time it won't be 6.25, it might be 6.3, it might be 6.4, it might be 6.5 or 6.31. And essentially what miners are doing or what the pools are doing when they construct the blocks is they're embedding the transactions in there. And so when a machine guesses correctly, all those transactions are added to the blockchain, embedded in the block. And usually then generally, so there's this word immutable that gets thrown around a lot, but generally, people say that, you know, your transaction is locked in and immutable after, say, you know, six blocks are added after that, because that's increasingly more difficult. So if you were to try undo or, you know, 51% attack the Bitcoin blockchain, which is you get 51% of the hash rate, you have to, if you wanted to go back 5 blocks, you have to undo every block before that fifth last block. You know, so that's, you know, immutable is obviously a very strong word to use, but the amount of energy that you'd have to expend to do that then is also extremely high. So that's essentially what's happening. You know, you'll have empty blocks, you know, you'll have blocks that get won with no transactions embedded in them. And then you'll have blocks that are, you know, when the network is extremely congested and extremely busy, the block reward could be 6.6 Bitcoin because of how many transaction fees, worth of fees are embedded in it.
Right, I get you. Yeah. Now, I suppose what I sort of struggle with is my transaction. If I put through a Bitcoin transaction, where is that, or what's going on? You know, because it's like the miners have to do, are miners validating the transactions to make sure that they're legitimate?
So the miners are building the blocks and they're embedding your transaction in the blocks and then they're broadcasting that block out and the nodes are the ones that are then confirming that that block was constructed correctly. So that's kind of another critical aspect of the nodes, which is a miner will build a block, they'll insert all the transactions in that 10-minute period, and then they'll broadcast that proof of work. Essentially, is kind of a phrase that's used a lot. They'll broadcast that proof of work out and all the nodes will automatically check that block to make sure there's not a transaction in there that was put in the previous block or 2 blocks ago. They'll make sure stuff isn't double spent and that everything has been constructed as it should. And it's the nodes then that give the tick and the all clear to say, yeah, that block was constructed exactly as it should, add it to the blockchain, and on, and then on you go to the next block after that.
And are each, let's say I have a miner, I'm constructing my own block, because every different miner around the world, you know, because in the in each block we're taking transactions from the mempool and dragging them
Yeah.
into it, but will all miners create the same block, or will they all have a different type of block because they'll be pulling different transactions, or is there a chain of command, I suppose, that you'll always stack your block or create it, so all miners have the same block with the same transactions?
Yeah, well, so what matters is the longest chain. So that you're focusing on the longest chain of truth, essentially, which is there's actually times as well where something, two pools could actually guess correctly at the exact same time. And you have, actually situations that people don't realize where you have like a momentary network split that actually happens. And what the nodes automatically do is look at the kind of heaviest and longest chain and say, look, well, 2 blocks are one at the exact same time. We can't have a network split. So this is the block we're going with. And then that's the longest chain. And that's the one that miners then focus on. So that's kind of exactly how you maintain that kind of chain of truth, which is people don't realize that, network splits happen, even though it's extremely, extremely small, probability wise, that two machines or two pools would guess the exact same time, but it does happen. But the nodes are the kind of the gatekeepers that ensure that, the proof of work continues on the longest chain, and that's where the focus lies.
Right, okay. Greenpeace was giving Bitcoin a bit of stick there about the proof of work, you know, with energy, and it's an attack vector, I suppose, as we hear talked about in politics as well, that like Bitcoin's using too much energy, and especially now as we go into, quote unquote, an energy crisis, when the cost of energy is going up and up and up. It does Bitcoin use too much energy? Is it a legitimate use of energy? Does it need to use this much energy? Where do you stand with that? How can you explain that to us, please?
Yeah, usually, the first thing I kind of mention with regards to this is that the Bitcoin network, I think as a whole, is probably using about 0.75% or something around that of, the global energy at the moment, which is, you would think that based on the narratives and the articles that you're reading, that it's using, 10% or 5%, it's only using 0.75%. That's the figures that, people have done the research on and see, but ultimately, those figures often overlook, a lot of critical aspects of Bitcoin mining, which is, people like Daniel Batten doing, really good research, which is methane capture mining, which is, running off of flare gas on oil and gas fields or landfills, is becoming hugely popular. And he's doing studies which shows, if Bitcoin was to continue its methane capture mining model and the expansion that it's currently seeing, Bitcoin could actually be carbon negative by 2025. So people are obsessed, I think, at the moment, especially Greenpeace, at looking at total consumption of the Bitcoin network instead of focusing on the characteristics of the energy consumption that lies underneath it. So they don't seem to realize that, total consumption is one figure, but the opportunities that this location agnostic, buyer of energy can offer can be quite positive. And so they'll just obsess over, Bitcoin uses X amount, that's all a waste. And they probably won't even include the likes of off-grid miners that are, using, methane reduction systems by, mining on oil and gas fields and landfills. They'll completely exclude all of that data, which in my mind, is extremely, extremely important. And that's why the likes of Daniel Batten, that, previously kind of had no interest in Bitcoin, he was probably along one of those, along the lines of those who are a skeptic of it, but has now kind of started to realize, look, Bitcoin mining is providing the financial incentive that these oil and gas guys and landfill operators need to put this gas through a generator instead of flaring it up into the atmosphere like they did before. And in reality, we're still if we're honest with ourselves, in a transitionary period. So while everyone wants this transition to renewables, okay, there's still a lot of oil and gas that needs to come out of the ground now. And that either comes out of the ground in a dirty way or it comes out of the ground in a more efficient way. And if Bitcoin mining can sit alongside it and make that process more efficient, then ultimately, in my mind, that's a net positive. And, you know, I think that the methane capture, you know, research is something that is, you know, really, really important. And I would encourage people to read it and go and look at Daniel Batten's research on it, because I think it would, you know, change a lot of people's minds about it. And a second kind of thing is, if you take away off-grid solutions, you know, the International Energy Agency have said that for us to meet our 2050 net zero goals, the world is going to need, you know, 500 gigawatts of demand side assets. And demand side assets are essentially energy consumers that sit on grids, but when they're called upon to turn off, they can do it in an instant. And what people are realizing in Texas is that Bitcoin miners are the perfect flexible assets you can put on heavily renewable grids, because you have the likes of a Riot facility that's 700 megawatts, which is a huge amount of consumption, that can essentially be shut off in stages in an instant. And so you had the likes of the Riot facility turning off this year for a cold snap in February indefinitely, and you had them turning off again during the heat wave this summer. And people keep saying, well, if they weren't sitting there in the first place, then, you know, they wouldn't be consuming. But what it's allowing is this huge overbuilding of renewable capacity, that when the rest of the grid needs that renewable capacity, or if that renewable capacity isn't producing like it should, the demand that's associated with that build out then cuts off. And so I think, you know, Bitcoin mining is going to play a huge part in the renewable infrastructure build out around the world. And as I said, you know, Bitcoin at the moment, I think, uses 11 gigawatts, you know, and at any given time. And if the world needs 500 gigawatts of demand side sitting on grids, you know, you could essentially slot the Bitcoin network into that multiple times over. So I think, in general, when you take into account this off-grid methane capture mining and the flexible on-grid asset that it can be, you know, they're really not looking at the bigger overall picture here, which is they can focus all they want on general total consumption. But if they're, you know, refusing to look under the layers of it and under the hood of Bitcoin mining and what it can offer, then they know they're really kind of missing the point, essentially.
Right. So basically, for renewables, we need to overbuild, but then we need something to absorb that, like I think you call them a flexible asset, something that you can turn on, turn off. And you see, is there any other flex, like what's an example, or is there another example of a flexible asset other than Bitcoin mining?
Yeah, well, so anything, to be honest, to an extent can operate as a flexible asset. So if you were to take Ireland as an example, you know, you can take, you know, industrial processes and they can be signed up to participate in something called DS3, which is basically demand side mechanisms. It's the same idea. So if you have a factory, if you have, say, just use an example, you know, a dairy gold or whatever it might be, they can be asked to turn down their consumption in order to alleviate stress on the grid system. But I suppose the kind of key part of the mining side of things is that it's essentially a single process energy consumer. The machines are just doing one thing and one thing only. They have no kind of human impact or human element. And I suppose the joy of Bitcoin mining, and what people don't realize, is that it's a perfectly interruptible process. You know, it's not like a data center where, you know, software and data is in the middle of being processed. And if you cut off that process, you know, you can corrupt data and you can interrupt processes, or you might need, if you're taking the likes of a more industrial process, you have to send people home early or disrupt their working day. You can put as much Bitcoin mining consumption on a grid system as you like. And then if the grid ever needs that stress alleviated, you can just cut it in seconds. And you're interrupting nothing, and you can just go straight back mining as soon as the grid is ready to have you back again. And I think that's exactly what they're demonstrating in ERCOT. And you have the CEO of ERCOT, you know, Brad Jones, saying, you know, mining is really filling a hole for us here in ERCOT, and it's really providing a lot of, you know, demand side mechanisms that we previously didn't have. So it's not that Bitcoin mining will be a silver bullet for renewable build out. You'll have your batteries, you'll have your green hydrogen participating. But in my mind, it'll certainly play a part, whether it be, you know, 10% of that renewable, you know, demand side expansion, whatever it might be. But it's certainly, based on the characteristics and the kind of general proof of concept we're seeing in Texas, I think in Ireland as well, it'll play a huge role.
Is there like, because it's a, like, that all sounds good and it sort of makes sense to me. But then, what was it, New York that banned mining recently, or did that go through? Like, is there danger for, you know, the political machine, which is all just games and money, not necessarily the right decision, but the rightly funded decision. Is there danger? Is it an attack vector because Bitcoin uses proof of work mining? Is it a legitimate attack vector for it, that we might go down the route that the likes of New York have gone and other countries might go along that way, for right or wrong?
I think it'd be kind of, naive to say it isn't, from our perspective. It was a very interesting kind of scenario for myself, which was when I was driving to and from, the site that we currently have running. I was just always listening on the radio to the EU, about the EU thinking of banning proof of work. And I was
Sure.
just kind of race against time in my head, which is, we're going to push along with this because we know the positive benefits that can have. It's just a case of educating people on it, as quickly and methodically as we possibly can before they make a rash and drastic decision like that. So it definitely is an attack vector. It's definitely something that they would try and do. But I suppose overall, all we can do, as a mining company that's, based in Ireland and operates in the European Union, is just explain what our vision is. So whether it be operating on landfills, whether it be operating with more anaerobic digesters, whether it be allowing more renewable build-out of infrastructure, all you can do is educate them as best you can. And I think when you also look at, China's attempt to ban proof of work, they thought they did a great job, and then, 6 months later, they still have 20% of the global hash rate coming from there. So banning it, isn't as simple, as it might seem. And I assume that, they're educated enough to understand that and look at what China did and how kind of poorly it turned out. So overall, I think it'll come around again. That whole conversation around banning proof of work and it using too much energy will be discussed. But in general, it's a simple enough explanation, which is, our prices and our energy situation is so bad in Europe anyway, as it is, that no one's mining. So this excuse that mining is the one that's kind of adding to the woes in Europe is so ridiculous in the first place that I think they'll also see that. And then when you want to explain about the benefits it could have possibly have, then I think it'll be a no-brainer that eventually, people might come to their senses and say, okay, banning this just isn't exactly the route that we should go down.
Sweet. So, proof of stake for a moment. Ethereum, the merge. So it's changed from proof of work. I kind of see it like, I don't know, the kid in school who's like just gonna do what the school teacher wants to get on the right side. Obviously, there's much more nuance than that. This is how Dini's head works, but it has transitioned to proof of stake. So therefore, it's basically stepped aside from all that proof of work, energy, renewables, all those headwinds. Can you explain proof of stake maybe, and a little bit about the what the differences are between proof of stake and proof of work?
Yeah, well, in the simplest terms, they've essentially done away entirely with the whole proof of work process, which is this whole concept that we already explained, which is, machines consuming energies, firing gases, and formulating blocks in that way. And they've replaced it with essentially something called validator nodes, which is where you essentially hand over, 32 Ethereum. And then as a result of that, you're then, designated a validator node, and you're given responsibilities to build blocks and behave, in the correct way. So again, proof of stake is just another civil resistance mechanism in the same kind of manner, which is you're asking someone to give up their Ethereum. That's their, skin in the game, and that's Ethereum's new method of ensuring that people behave in the correct way, which is, building blocks correctly, responding when they should, and ultimately, not including double spent coins, whatever it might be. But that's their new method of ensuring that people who build blocks and monitor the blockchain and do whatever they need to do it in a correct manner. And now that their biggest kind of point about it is that because they've done away with this whole proof of work mechanism, they kind of flaunt the idea that, it's 99%, less energy intensive or whatever. I think that's the figure that they put out there. So it's certainly a different process, but as you kind of mentioned, it has its own nuances then as well.
What are the disadvantages to it then? So it's 99% more energy efficient. We'll say, well, we can argue that point, but it uses 99% less energy. Let's just say that. But what's the trade-offs? What's Ethereum losing?
Yeah, I think ultimately, as in, I wouldn't like to talk about this idea of securities, etc. I think that's a very weak point about it. But ultimately, I think centralization does become a bit of an issue. And I also think this whole concept of giving people more power over a network based on the monetary holdings or the monetary contribution that they make is a dangerous path to go down. Essentially, as those individuals are now going to be receiving greater yields because they're staking more Ethereum. In my mind, that concentration now is only going to increase as you go along. And so I think that's kind of the key trade-off in my mind, which is, you know, people, you know, always argued about this concept of Ethereum's pre-mining, that, you know, how it was created, which is, you know, people were allocated tokens based on, you know, investment and money that they put into the network. But because Bitcoin or Ethereum was operating on a proof of work mechanism, the power was almost coming away from those individuals that had, you know, accumulated a lot of Ethereum at the very beginning. But I think in this recent swap to proof of stake, they've essentially put them back in the driver's seat, which is, in my mind, you know, I think it's just a dangerous route to go down that path. You're essentially linking security with monetary accumulation, which in my mind, it doesn't make sense. I think a really interesting point you're seeing now, which is proof of work, which is people say, oh, well, Bitcoin price, you know, has a direct correlation to network security, because if the Bitcoin price goes down, miners turn off, and that, you know, leaves you more susceptible to a 51% attack, because, you know, you've less hash rate now that's operating, and so people can accumulate more hash rate and make it a bit easier. But what you're seeing recently on the Bitcoin network is, even with the drawdown in price from 68,000 or whatever it peaked at to 20,000, you know, Bitcoin's network hash rate has been going absolutely parabolic over the past 6 months. It doesn't seem to want to stop going up, which I think is blowing a lot of people's models kind of out of the water with regards to, you know, Bitcoin network security, which is, they kind of argue the point that, you know, Bitcoin's network security and the whole mining process was very closely linked to the Bitcoin price, but you're seeing the exact opposite at the moment. And I don't think you'll have that, you know, disparity. You'll have a higher correlation between, you know, Ethereum price and yield for staking and the security of that network in comparison to the likes of Bitcoin, you know, which is something that I actually didn't even envisage happening. You know, I thought that you would eventually see, you know, network hash rates start to drop off as margins got squeezed, but it just seems relentless at the moment. Every single week I'm checking the network difficulty, and it just seems an increase after increase after increase. So I think that's, you know, a really critical point, especially when people look at, you know, the safety of proof of work and the security scenario of proof of work over the next kind of two cycles as the block rewards start to come down. I think at the moment people would argue that we almost have too much security on the Bitcoin network at the moment, and that we could do a bit of a dropping off so that, you know, miner revenues picked up. But, you know, ultimately it's better for the network that you're seeing this parabolic increase in network hash rate while price starts to drop on.
Right, okay, yeah. So that's what I was wondering is, if a Bitcoin miner doesn't want the hash rate to keep going up because it means their industry is becoming more and more competitive and more difficult to get ahead. And then if I understand the proof of stake correctly, it's the larger your stake of Ethereum, the larger your reward. And this is how it trends towards centralization, because the bigs are going to get bigger.
Essentially, yeah, it's the simplest way that I would compare the two as well.
Okay, right, I get it. Let's chat a little bit about skilling, which I always pronounce wrong.
Yeah, right.
What have you guys been up to since we talked last? I know you've been super busy. I've seen a massive mining operation on the back of a lorry going off to an anaerobic digester, which looked pretty awesome. But can you tell us a little bit about what you've been working on or doing since we spoke last?
Yeah, I suppose, you know, a lot has changed in the past kind of 6 months since we spoke. I'm not even sure if I mentioned the first time we spoke that this was in the works, but we essentially got Ireland's first mining site up and running. So we're running on off of an anaerobic digester, which is, you know, co-located actually on top of an anaerobic digester. We have a unit that has 35 machines running flat out inside there, consuming about
what's an anaerobic digester? Because I know if I was listening to that, it'd just be words. Tell me.
Yeah.
You know me, every time I talk to you, I can't even remember what they're called. I don't even know what I'd be saying. It's only recently I've learned the name, but sure, I'll probably forget it. What's an anaerobic digester for those of us who have no idea?
Yeah, so wind and solar is kind of the thing that everyone kind of knows about in Ireland and seems to be the go-to. And anaerobic digestion was actually something that took me quite a long time to find. So when we were starting skilling, I think I realized that, you know, in order for us to have the simplest opening working model and, you know, pilot concept in Ireland, it needed to be something simple. And what anaerobic digestion essentially does is it takes in farm and food waste, And it basically swirls it around. And as that food farm and food waste decomposes, you get methane. And that methane is then extracted from these large tanks, and it's essentially burnt in a generator, and you get electricity. And so that's essentially what we're running off at the moment. But the reason it's a match made in heaven for Bitcoin mining and for the kind of renewable operator of the anaerobic digester is that for miners, because the anaerobic digester is fed this consistent supply of farm and food waste, you're basically getting a consistent supply of gas and a consistent supply of electricity, which is great for miners as you're getting that consistent uptime. And then you're also giving these anaerobic digestion producers a new kind of revenue model. So traditionally with an anaerobic digester, you might have a 500 kilowatt anaerobic digester that exports 500 kilowatts of electricity to the grid. But these sites could probably ramp up their production to 700 or 750 kilowatts, because based on how you change your inputs. So if you put in, you know, 99% grass and 1% food waste, you get, in very simple terms, you might get 500 kilowatts. But because food has a higher calorific value, you essentially can get more gas out of it. So, but previously, a lot of these individuals had absolutely no incentive to do that, because you're not going to use this energy on your site anyway, or on your farm or in your home. So they were just taking as much farm waste as they needed to produce their 500 kilowatts to export to the grid. But what I suppose mining is now offering these individuals is an opportunity to take in more, either more waste or a different type of waste that could give them more electricity. So if they can ramp up their current anaerobic digestion setup to 750 kilowatts, the grid infrastructure in that area can still only take 500. You know, it's not a case of pulling down power lines and giving them chunkier ones. It's not as simple as that. You know, it's a big capital expenditure to change, you know, grid infrastructure in a given area. Now they finally have this little buyer that'll sit, you know, co-located next to them and buy that energy off them. So that's basically what we've worked on for the past 6 months since we last spoke. We got our first pilot site up and running. It's been running since the very first week of June. So it's been running flat out for 4 months. And now, you know, we only kind of put it out there in August that this is what we've been working on for quite a long time, because we really wanted to do our due diligence on it. You know, this is our kind of first real large scale site. So we left it running for 8 or 9 weeks just to ensure that everything ran exactly as we expected it would. And it did, which was great. And we put it out there, and the reaction, you know, in my opinion, has been really, really good. You know, we've been kind of delighted to see what the reaction has been. And we've had guys from Cointelegraph over, we've had Joe Hall and a number of individuals that have traveled from, you know, the UK, and Jackson DeMond coming from New York, who's also a member of Cointelegraph, to, you know, do a little video on it and a bit of a mini documentary, because there isn't a lot of these that are running off of biogas globally. And obviously people look at the price of electricity in Ireland and think, you know, mining is, you know, essentially impossible. So when they see one running off of a farm here, that, you know, they're quite surprised, to say the least. So it's been great. You know, it's been great for us. And it's also been great, you know, I suppose for European mining and Irish mining and, you know, people that are involved in the Irish Bitcoin community to see, you know, Bitcoin advocates, you know, pushing something on a public scale like this. So overall, you know, we've been pretty happy with how the past 6 months have panned out.
You're putting us on the map.
So, you know, so I think we deserve to be on it, in fairness. You know, I think overall, you know, Europe has been given, you know, Bitcoin and mining a pretty harsh rap kind of over the past 12 months. And, you know, if we can at least just educate people on it, or educate the people that will be, in, you know, inevitably making the kind of tough decisions on Bitcoin and proof of work in Europe over the next 12 months, you know, that would be, you know, a pretty big win for us, aside from, you know, getting more containers out there and increasing our own hash rate. I think, you know, this model will hopefully be something that the people that make the important decisions see as meaningful and valuable. And overall, you know, I'd love to see the understanding of mining and what it can offer, you know, improve in Ireland and across Europe over the next 12 months.
Yeah, it's all about education, I suppose, and getting smart lads like you to try and explain it to lads like me. Mark, I want to thank you for coming on and having a chat. Is there anywhere people can follow Ceiling Mining or connect with you guys?
Yeah, so I suppose our Twitter is just @skilling_mining. Our website is skillingmining.com. I suppose my own email, if you want to reach out to me and ask questions, or, you know, I'm always open to just having Zooms with people for half an hour that are just generally interested. You know, even if you have nothing that you're interested in, you know, in terms of buying, you know, a mining unit, if it's just pure interest and wanting to learn more, you know, mark@skillingmining.com is my email. And I'm always kind of happy to, as you alluded to, educate people in whatever way I can, especially the people that are skeptical about it, because what we've realized in here is that people come in the door or our office in Cork City and they're very, very skeptical to begin with, you know, especially kind of some energy producers, because of what they're reading and what they're hearing from the EU and what they're reading in the Financial Times. But when they sit down and walk through what Bitcoin mining can offer and when they understand it as an energy bolt-on and all these other positives that it can bring, they do tend to pivot quite quickly. And, you know, they go away for 3 or 4 weeks and they come back with more questions. So, you know, if I can be that catalyst for more people understanding Bitcoin mining and Bitcoin in general, then, you know, I'll be more than happy to do so. So be sure to reach out at, you know, any of those sources.
Yeah, that's awesome. You're doing sterling work down there in Cork. Well, sure, I look forward to catching up with you again in another couple of months to see what you've been doing in the future. And for today, I'll just say thanks for coming on.